Good morning, everyone. Good evening, good afternoon, good night, whatever the time zone you are is. Can we please have the recording started?
Recordings have been started. You may begin.
Thank you very much. And welcome to the CCWG on Enhancing Accountability Meeting number 44 on the 23rd of July, 2015. We have a long agenda ahead of us. And at this point, I would like to do the roll call based on the attendees on the Adobe Connect room. But I would also ask for those who are not in the Adobe Connect room but are on the phone bridge to state their names, if there are any, so that we can add it to the roll call. So are there any attendees that are on the phone bridge but are not connected to the Adobe Connect room?
Hi, this is Greg Shatton. I'm only on the phone bridge now. I'll be on Adobe later.
Thank you, Greg. Anyone else? Okay, I see. I hear no one else being just on the phone bridge. And, well, as usual, I remind you of filing your statement of interest if you haven't done so. And, as usual, the staff will be happy to assist you if you need any help on doing so. We would also like to apologize to our GNSO counselors and members of this group and all participants of this group, because we know that there is an overlap between this call and the GNSO Council call today. So we tried by all means to avoid that clash, but it wasn't possible. So we do apologize to all of those who are in the position of the clash course of these calls. So, as I said, we have a very packed agenda, and I see Kavu's hand is up. Kavu, would you like to say something at this point?
Already.
Mm-hmm.
He said it already.
Mm-hmm.
Kavu.
We have signed a paper. Is it the same thing in the CCWG, or is it just simple declaration verbally? In ICG, the ICANN Secretariat approached us, and we put everything in a very simple paper, putting a cross on various areas, indicating the issue of conflict of interest. This is very important. I'm not asking you to do it at this stage, but I think we should have it. And we should mention something that the conflict of interest was properly processed during the CCWG. That is helpful for the public comments that now people have respected this issue of conflict of interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. I really have no idea of which document you're referring to, but we'll certainly look into it, and I'll ask the staff to provide some information on this document that you stated, and I guess it relates to the statement of interest that everyone needs to file. So thank you for reminding us that this is very important. And with no further delay, and since we have a very long agenda ahead, I'd like to turn to Matthew for our next agenda item. So, Matthew.
Thank you very much, Leon. This is Mathieu Veil speaking. Our agenda today is very busy with a number of sections of the draft report for public comment number 2 to review. And you've seen two key sections. We've tried to put the items that we believe need the most discussions up front so that we have sufficient time. And the goal on this review sections is to make the decisions that will enable the finalization of the drafting, which has to take place before tomorrow, and then be transmitted to the independent counsel for review over the weekend, and then we finalize on the next call on Tuesday. And so the first item we had to on our list as a follow-up from the meeting in Paris is the removal of individual board members, and some additional work has been conducted by Work Party 1 in the very short time that we had this at the beginning of this week. And so I would like to now turn to Jordan for a quick introduction and identifying which key decisions you are requiring or needing from us at this point. Jordan?
Thanks, Matthew. Is my voice coming through?
Absolutely.
Great. Hi, everyone. Just 10 past midnight here in Wellington, or 5 past. Staff, could you put the latest version of the removal of board members' power on the screen? We'll just start with that. It's a red line that should be reasonably easy to digest. Now, if my memory serves, which it might not, we did talk about this on our call 2 days ago. It was here and it went. The changes should not be too substantial. Yeah, that's the wrong version of the document, Grace. Sorry. We just need the version that's the absolute latest that was circulated, which is version 5, which I emailed around about 13 hours ago. We're doing removal of individual directors here. Sorry, everyone. There's no point talking without the doc.
Jordan,
if you want me to resend this to you, please let me know. The basic change that was made to draw to your attention is on the previous version of this paper, we still hadn't resolved in the case of SOs in the at-large community that appoint directors, whether they were the only parties that could lead to the recall of those directors. We did resolve that question by a clear majority on the Working Party call, whatever it was, 7 a.m. this morning, so 17 hours or so ago, and removed it. So I just want to draw that to your attention. The remaining point for CCWG discussion that came up in the WP1 call, where there was an agreement, is that you'll recall in Paris we talked about the development of possible community standards as part of work stream 2 that could help to guide SOs and ACs when they were dealing with decisions to remove or not. That was part of the package that was also included the notion of discussing recall removals of individual directors in the community forum or ICANN community assembly before any decision was made. So that's represented in paragraph 11 of this paper, just down the end of page 2 and overlapping onto page 3. So there was some concern about that. Some members of Working Party 1 did not want to refer to those standards. I think that there was, it's up to those people to express their point of view. I'm just reporting back here. But we agreed to send the document through with it as it was for decision here. So that's the key decision to make, whether we leave that reference to standards in there or not. And I think that the rest of this is ready to go. So, Matthew, can I hand it back to you unless you'd like to draw attention of anyone to any other aspect of this?
No, thank you very much, Jordan. I think that's a very clear and concise introduction. And we can move to the queue for questions. And I think Sébastien has the first place in the queue. Sébastien?
Thank you, Mathieu. Sébastien Bachelet speaking. Jordan, can you tell us what was the Web Party 1 regarding the option who was open? I didn't see the version 5, and I don't know what was your choice as a group. Thank you very much.
Sorry, could you just restate that question, Sébastien? What the decision was that we made about what?
You start saying that there were one decision to be taken by the Web Party 1, and if I go to the version 4, that was the last version I was able to read, there were, does WP1 recommend, and there were three options, and you say at the beginning of your presentation that you made a choice, you as a group, the WP1 made a choice by a large majority, and I would like to know what was your choice. Thank you.
So in the previous, in the version 4 of this paper, there was the same paragraph 4 that's there at the bottom of page 1 now. There may be some very small grammatical changes, but otherwise there was that paragraph 4. And then there was an alternative paragraph in brackets which suggested that for the 7 directors appointed by the 3SOs and at-large community, a process that led to a decision by the community mechanism could lead to that director's removal. And the three options underneath that bracketed text were whether we should suggest to the CCWG only the non-bracketed, so paragraph 4 that's there, whether we should ask the CCWG to choose between those two options, or whether we should suggest to the CCWG that it presents both options for consultation in this paper. And we discussed that, and there was no one who was voting. We eliminated the options option, if you like, because we realized we don't want to go out in this public comment to with options on questions for the community to respond to. So that left us either asking the CCWG to decide about the bracketed text or whether to go with what you see there in paragraph 4. There was unanimous support on the WP1 call to just leave the text that's there in front of us.
Thank you, Jordan. The next is James.
Hi, James Gunnan. So I'll speak to the issue that Jordan mentioned about paragraph 11. So if everybody wants to move to paragraph 11, this is around the standards for a possible petition to remove individual directors. Now, I was one of the ones who didn't agree with having a set of standards that would directly lead to the removal or petitioning to remove a director. Now, Jordan has done some work on this since our last call, and I appreciate that. So the top of page 3, the such standards which would help establish, has been added, and that's a great addition. But I would still like to suggest to the CCWG that on the end of page 2, that the text from and the expectations which have not met could lead to a petition for their removal. Myself and a number of others have issue, I suppose, with that specific section of text. I think as a group, have decided that having standards for board directors is obviously a great thing, and it's definitely something that we should pursue. However, we have issues with that specific section of text that breaching those expectations may lead directly to a petition for their removal. I would like just to be a little more unambiguous in paragraph 11. I would suggest the removal of the phrase and the expectations of which, if not met, would be expected to lead to a petition for their removal. I think if we took out that second half of that sentence there, the paragraph would be a lot more acceptable to the larger group.
Thank you, James. I think this some wording refinements suggested in the chat already. Next is Adam.
Thank you. A couple of things. First of all, you'll note there's some highlighted, the percentages are, not the percentages, the fractions are highlighted in paragraph 6. There is still an ongoing discussion on, in general, thresholds to remove. Are you still hearing me?
Yes, I can hear you, Alan.
Okay, thank you. There's still an ongoing discussion on what thresholds should be used or could be used for community removals. A few of us have identified some real troublesome problems because of abstentions and things like that. So I think we have to keep those numbers frozen at this point. And that's for all of the community powers, not necessarily this one. With regard to the reason for removing directors, I have some real concerns on that. I believe ultimately if we ever remove directors, it's not going to be for a specific cause other than they're not meeting our expectations. And whether that's because of particular behavior patterns or, I don't think we can specify right now. And I don't really want to set expectations that we will have to list specific causes and potentially enter into debate. We're talking about giving them an opportunity to defend themselves. And my understanding is under California law, the member can remove, period. It's not subject to qualification. It's not subject to appeal. And I have a real problem if we're setting expectations that we're going to have a laundry list or anything resembling a laundry list of the reasons that we can use for removal. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. And I think it's worth reminding us that in the discussion in Paris, others had strong concerns about the ability for ASO or AC to remove in what they perceived as arbitrary manner their board directors. So my understanding is that the proposition that's currently in this document is an intermediate position, a sort of compromise between both positions, so that we can get to a level where everyone can live with. Cavus, you're next.
This text from the very beginning, and once you have passed a paragraph, that would in your notes saying that this paragraph is agreed. Otherwise, we're jumping from 6 to 11, 11 to 21, and back, and it is difficult to follow. This is one question. And the second, I agree with you that it should not be arbitrary. It should have some justification. But it's difficult to list all justifications, because some of them may be subjective, some of them may not be subjective. So we should avoid to say arbitrary removal. We should say by some cause or some reasons, but to list them, it is very difficult because we may not be able to list everything now. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Greg?
Thank you, Greg Shatton, for the record. First, I think that on the work party one discussion, there was no consensus or decision taken that this text was agreed by all parties. So it's still, it's basically been taken to this group to make decisions. So for my part, I have concerns, deep concerns with the way this text is currently standing. Fundamentally, I think it needs to be the right of each SO and AC that appoints directors currently to be able to remove those directors without interference by any other SO or AC. So the idea that they have to petition the rest of the community in order to remove a director who they believe is fundamentally no longer meeting their requirements as their appointed director is, I think, a huge mistake. I think it goes in the really in the wrong direction from where we currently are. It's also really it goes against the spirit of the statute. Under the letter of the statute, in California law, of course, if we have a sole member, then that member is technically appointing that director. But we've always said that that should be a mere pass-through, that there should be no interference on the way in. I think there should be no interference on the way out either. This is kind of, it's like forcing somebody to stay in a marriage.
Hey. Can I ask Jordan to confirm whether that's actually the way the text is currently drafted? Because I'm afraid there might be a misunderstanding here. Jordan?
Greg, the story you've just described is the opposite of what the text provides for. The text is really clear that where there's an appointment by the SONAC, Southern Directors, the only body that can remove them is that SORAC. The petitioning thing is simply a triggering threshold within the SONAC to start consideration of the question. I don't know where you got the idea that we were proposing in this version of the text that SONAC would have to appeal to any other body. The whole point of what I tried to explain, obviously not very well just before, was that that isn't the route that we're recommending going down.
Well, I'm looking at paragraph 6. It says there needs to be a petition. To start the, regardless of whether the director is appointed by NSO or AC, there has to be a petition that's started, and then it needs to go to a meeting of the community assembly. And then that community assembly is supposed to make the decision whether the director is moved or not.
No, I'm sorry, it doesn't say that, Greg. No, it doesn't. It says the decision-making body. The SOAC's governing body or the community mechanism. So what's intended to be common is whether or not it's a nominating committee director or an SOAC one, someone has to trigger the question. So it's the SOAC itself in A, or for a NOMCOM appointed director, it's any SOAC. The step that is, if you like, an interference is the B one, which requires a discussion to be had about the question in the public community forum. And the logic behind that is that these things shouldn't be done behind closed doors. And that's, I'm not endorsing or criticizing that logic. I'm just saying that's the logic that's represented.
Okay, well,
there would be the decision made for the SOAC appointed directors. The decision is the SOAC council. And for the NOMCOM appointed directors, the decision is the community mechanism as a single member.
Okay, well, that's not well respect. That's not well expressed at all. And the main problem is in 6C, since there's no clear delineation of the decision-making body. It really needs to say, at least it should say, the SOAC's governing body in the case of a director nominated by an SORAC, or the community mechanism in the case of NOMCOM directors, or something like that. Because it's not clear. It's just not clear. And I see it's not clear to others. Maybe in, I don't know if this was the document you delawyered, but maybe you over-delawyered it, because it's no longer readily understandable.
This is not the document I delawyered.
Okay, well, maybe it needs to be lawyered a little then, or at least clarified. 6C needs to be clarified because it leads to misunderstanding in that case. Secondly, I just want to say that I'm against this idea of criteria.
Okay.
I just want to say that I'm against the idea of criteria, and especially the idea that criteria have to form the basis of any decision. I agree with Alan. The point is, if it's just not working, it's not working, and there shouldn't be a requirement. And I don't think it's going to be arbitrary. Removing a director is serious. Finding a new director is also serious. It's not going to be arbitrary. So that should not be part of this proposal, and 6C needs to be cleared up so it's clear that the community assembly has no ability or right to stop an SORAC from removing their director. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Alan, second time.
Thank you very much. By the way, I agree that 6C does need clarification in that parenthetical. It does need to say which of the either ors it needs to say for what the ors are. That's easy to fix. I'd like to go back to the issue of criteria and reasons for dismissing, and let me give you an example that is the kind of thing that troubles me most. We have used as the classic example of an improper removal by an ACSO that if the director does not support or does not object to a specific budget item, that the ACSO will just unilaterally remove them. And we've said that that's really the wrong reason that we would want to remove a director. We shouldn't punish them because they didn't vote the way we wanted in a specific vote. On the other hand, we have the ability of selectively removing directors as a surgical way of addressing overall ICANN budget issues. That's exactly why we have individual removal directors, so we don't have to remove the whole board. We can just remove the recalcitrant directors who are insisting on a budget the community doesn't like. So we're using the exact same rationale for both the kind of removal that we're saying is bad and the kind of removal that we're saying is good. And I don't know how we put that in words to describe that, well, sometimes budget refusal or voting for a budget item we didn't like is something we can't remove them for, and voting for a budget item that our specific budget item is something that we explicitly want to remove them for. I think that's a real conflict, and I don't think we can fix it other than relying on the good sense of the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. I will close the queue after Sebastian. Cavus?
The difficulty in 6A, B, C, and D is quite clear. And I don't understand why we have to go to such a detail of the issue and so on and so forth. It's quite clear. You have the petition. Petition is met. CA will be established, questioning, answering, patati patata, and then each stage after you start the process, and then you have a threshold of those who vote and threshold of those who participate in the issue that means quorum. So I think quite clear. I don't see why we have to redraft that. Why we have to spend another 2 or 3 hours to draft something and come back to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Jordan?
I from a hand by accident. I just want to, I will make the point since I do have the mic, that the intention of the paragraph 11 is not to impose any restrictions or any limitations power of the community mechanism single member for NOMCOM directors or on SOs or ACs to qualify the removal. I personally am a strong supporter of there not being any restrictions on that power, and it has never been my intention to draft in a different way given the writing instructions that the CCWG Working Party has come up with. So if we can clarify that a bit by deleting the thing after the first comment in that last line on paragraph 11 and the expectations, blah, 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 then it simply sets out the development of standards that will help guide people about expected behavior, and they would help us, that those standards could help establish common expectations across the community. And then it explicitly says, even in bold, there not be criteria for or limitations on. So I think that text after the comma does add a bit of possible confusion, so it should be ditched. And I think the discussion about that paragraph 6 has been helpful. I think it should just be repeated. So after paragraph 4, which talks about SOAC directors, you'd explain how it was done with a paragraph like 6. And after paragraph currently numbered 5, for the non-com directors, you'd have it again. Totally separates processes out, no and ors, no cross-referencing, no requirement to read the whole document in order to understand every part of it. So those are helpful clarifications.
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Jordan. I had been supposed to close the queue after Sebastian, and I think we'll have another list of items so far, and we've actually progressed a little bit, so I think we will be able to take stock hopefully sooner. Sebastian?
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Mathieu. Sebastian Bachelet speaking. I have a question. We discussed in the Paris meeting about the question of the independence of the board members, and I don't see, maybe I didn't read well, but I don't know where it is mentioned and what we will do on that, because I think for the moment, all the discussion is contradictory to what it's told to the board member and what they need to behave. And I have trouble with this way of doing this empowerment of the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. I think there's the expected standards of behavior in paragraph 11. Are meant to be where we could discuss about these things, so that we have everyone's expectations clarified. That's my understanding of the process. Greg and Cavus, please be very short. To Jenny, I was supposed to have closed the line already, but it's your first time. So Greg and Cavus, you've been speaking already, so please be very concise. Greg?
I'll just say briefly that Section 11, I think, is improved if we remove and the expectations, et cetera, in that first sentence. I still have deep misgivings about trying to codify these expected behaviors, but I think that can be argued in Workstream 2, unless people believe that this binds us to when Workstream 2 develops those. In which case I would object to it being that strong. I think it should be a recommendation to consider the development of community standards rather than anything that would bind us. So that would be my suggestion on 11. I recommend considering the development of. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Cavus?
Not on this question. On the general, I see now here ICANN Community Assembly. Does it mean that we have removed community forum and we have removed community council? These two terms no longer appear in the text. We have decided to put ICANN community assembly instead of community forum or the community council. Is it correct understanding or not? Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. I think that's a question that was raised at a later stage in the Paris meeting. I suggest we take it when we discuss the community mechanism. That's somewhere when we need to harmonize the wording. It's a very good point, but probably not at this point of the discussion. Tijani, and then we'll close.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. Tijani speaking. I'd like to ask what is the use of this standard of action for the board members? It seems that it doesn't have any effect, since we don't want to use it at all, even to have the sense, to consult people. Even people are afraid that this standard of action will be more or less a cause or criteria for removal. We said it will be the reference for the discussion about the removal of the director. People don't want it. So what it is for? We will use it where? Is it usable? Thank you.
Jordan, do you want to briefly respond?
I could, but I got distracted in the middle of Tijani's statement. I apologize. Mathieu, can you respond?
So the question from Tijani was how does the expected behaviors would be useful if no one wants to use it. I mean, I guess Tijani was referring to other interventions that were saying they were not interested in being prescriptive to the board. And
Well, from my point of view, the reason that they're useful is I'm not aware of any sort of contemporary or recent declaration, if you like, on the part of the community about the sort of behavior it expects from the board or from board members. So to the extent that a useful process did test some views on that, and if it was possible to come to a consensus through some process on that, I can't see that as anything other than positive. And I think that was the notion, that if there was some agreed community statement about what it wanted, that board members would at least have that as a thing that was... Sorry, we're having two conversations at once. That it would be a desirable... That it would be a desirable thing to have in and of itself. And the bindingness or otherwise of it is kind of beside the point from that point of view.
Thank you, Jordan. Anand, I have closed the queue twice, and you've been speaking already a number of times, so I would be tempted to close now the queue because we have other items. I think we have identified the need for clarifications in different parts of this section. Paragraph 6 will be restructured, as Jordan described, to be more explicit, and that's certainly a place where we will need some explain help to provide more clarity to the external reader. And we will also review the wording of paragraph 11, taking into account the fact that we obviously have diverging views about this board director removal. We should never forget that there were some comments on this. And the attempt here is to provide some place where no one is perfectly happy with the solution, but it's still something we all can live with. So I think that's with the appropriate corrections, we are getting as close as possible from that point. And I'm looking forward to a next version where I encourage everyone to really think hard whether that's something they cannot live with and why, or whether that is not the place where we could probably move forward with. I think we have a good balance in the spirit of the discussions in Paris around this. And with that, I'm moving now to the next section, and Thomas will chair this section. Thomas?
Thank you very much, Mathieu. And I'm afraid that it's again on Jordan to help us with this discussion. We're now going to discuss the board recall. By way of introduction, we will have to discuss refined language on the board recall mechanism, and also we should try to close the discussion on the caretaker board question. And without any further ado, I'd like to hand over to John.
Thanks, Thomas. Lovely. So this paper is in front of you, and what happened here was that our wonderful council did a really big marked-up version of this paper that took the draft that we had, the few paragraphs that we had, and added on to it a lot of procedural detail that among it included the model 4 that we'd suggested there was some consensus around in Paris for what to do about the caretaker board. And the essence of that was when an SORAC came to a meeting to remove the board, it would have to nominate replacement directors at that point. So what this has done is basically implement that. And my concern was, it was a big red line document. We were just at the end of a two-hour working party call, and WP1 doesn't feel like it's had enough time to consider this properly. So this doesn't come with any particular recommendation yet from WP1. Unhelpful as it is, we are going to be discussing that at our call next Tuesday on the 27th. But that said, it's helpful to sketch out the key points
about it today, which is the petition to trigger this power has to come from at least one SO and one AC, and is only valid when two-thirds of them sign it to trigger the power. And then there's a bunch of process stuff set out in the next bullet point as you work through the document that is kind of the mechanism, if you like, for how this would work. The yellow blob is noting that if there is a recall vote, a current member of the board would not be able to serve on the interim board, which is a short-term board that takes office until the re-election process rolls in with new directors. On the top of page 2, it includes that liberation stage where SOs and ACs do discuss this power before they exercise it. And then the decision is made by the SOs and ACs through their own processes after that, and the votes are tallied up. And the threshold is set out there. As we've already mentioned elsewhere, we need to go through these voting thresholds in the community mechanism and really sort them out for the consultation. And there's some more explanation of that in paragraph 6. Then paragraph 7 and 8 is available to set out a bit more about the interim board that would take office. And it would be for a fixed period that's proposed. 120 days was the lawyer's initial pitch down there. James asked a question about the guidelines for interim board members. I'm not entirely convinced, but I did manage to add that. But it's been added in the workstream 2 latest version, even if it hasn't been added in this version. I think that's what Matthew's saying. So if you carry on down there, it specifies that when the replacement board comes along, so that's when the SOs, ACs have elected new members, people who were previously on the board can be reappointed. The next bullet point notes that for the legal reasons our advisors set out, the interim board does have the same legal powers as the general board, but there's a suggestion the bylaws will show the caretaker convention that needs to be there. So I don't really know how you want to handle this one, Thomas. People might just raise any issues they've got with the general approach, which again is that it's a decision of the community mechanism of a single member with high thresholds and a high petitioning threshold to get the discussion moving. That if once the people come to the meeting to make a decision or a call about this, they need to have alternative directors ready to go. That forms a short-term interim board, which is then replaced by a replacement board where people are appointed into the seats on the same terms and so on that the removed board members were. And I think I might leave it at that.
Thanks very much, John. That has been most helpful, and thanks to you and your group for refining this. As you can see, what has been called option number 4 for caretaker board has now found its way into the language of this updated proposal. Now, as a queue is forming, we are basing this discussion on previous discussions made by the group and a forming consensus. Can I please ask you to make explicit reference to the parts of this language that you are either supportive of or that you would like to see amended, and also if you can, please do make suggestions on what rewording needs to take place so that you can support what's now in the AC room. Lastly, I would like to ask you to keep your interventions as brief as possible, and also to only address points that are a must if you wish for you to buy into this. So let's maybe reserve what wordsmithing for a later stage when we finalize our upcoming report. Sebastian.
Thank you, Thomas. Sebastian Bachelet for the record. I have a few questions to understand before going to say something about my position, but on the end of the page one, SO and AC must nominate at least one such prospective director. I have trouble to understand what that means. Is it each or it is altogether one? I have also a question on the 8. We are talking about committee recall on individual directors, and my question is it I guess it's only from the non-com, but it's not very clear. The point Sebastian, 9.
Can you say that one again, Sebastian, about paragraph 8?
Yeah, at the end of the paragraph 8, it's written the last line, community recall on an individual director. I guess it's from the nominating committee, if I understood well my quick reading, but if not, I will be happy to know if it's for all or just the one from the non-com.
Just the non-com one.
Yeah, then I, at least in my understanding of the English, and it's not the best one, I know you must say it again that it's individual director from the non-com. On the point 8-9, I really totally disagree, really very heavily. We need to have diversity requirement. If not, it's a way of capture. It's a very easy way of capture by part of the community, and I think that diversity is a must in any case, even for an interim board, especially if the interim board have all the capability of a so-called normal board. And I guess it's my last point, but it's also for me a very important one. It's when we talk about replacement of the board, I just want to remind you that I asked the question in the Paris meeting about capture. I didn't see a lot of things on this question, but the fact that one committee, the non-com here, is able to change more than half of the board voting member, or just half if we include the president and CEO, it's for me a very important possible way of capture by one of the group of the board, one of the group capturing the board. And we need to answer this question. Thank you very much. I don't know if I answer your question, Thomas, but to be clear, I will not buy this power like it is today, and I will not buy either the one who recall or will remove a single board member. And if you want me to elaborate later on, I will do so. If not, that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. And actually, I applaud you for being so specific in your comment. So that's very helpful. With respect to your general concerns relating to the board removal recall mechanisms, this is well noted. You've gone on record specifying this already, so I think there's no need for you to explain more at this very moment where we are applying changes to the language. Let me try to capture the points that you spoke to and respond to them briefly. With respect to your first question, it's my understanding that it is one each. With respect to the second question, we will note an action item for Jordan's group to make the language more explicit, if need be, with respect to NOMCOM. With respect to the diversity requirement or the exemption thereof for the caretaker board, I hear what you're saying. It was my impression that there were huge concerns inside the group that we could need diversity of an interim board. I sympathize with the notion that we need to take diversity very seriously. So I would really like to encourage those that also want to make diversity a requirement for a caretaker board to make themselves heard. Again, it was my observation from the group that that we might not be able to do that. But again, I'm willing to put it into the language if there's more traction for that. And with respect to the issue of capture, I would suggest that we put that in as an action item for Cheryl and Steve to include that as a special topic for their stress test to ensure that by us installing caretaker mechanisms that we don't open the floodgates for capture. But let's have it tested before we tweak this language. That's at least my recommendation. And unless I hear otherwise from the group, I suggest we move on the basis of that. Next in line is Julie.
Thank you very much, Julie Hammer from ESSEC. I just want to raise the issue of how board liaisons might be treated under this situation of recalling the entire ICANN board and indeed in relation to the last community power about recalling individual board members. As you know, liaisons don't have a vote on the board, but in most other respects they are usually highly participating board members. So I guess my question to the group is how, firstly, do we need to explicitly mention whether this this proposed way of treating board members and the recall of the entire board should also apply to liaisons, or do we need to specify that they do not fall under this process?
Thanks very much, Julie. I guess that's a good question. In my view, the liaisons are not being seated by the SOs and AACs. So I support Jordan's view in the chat that if we remain silent, nothing happens to them. I would suggest we test that with legal counsel we're using. So we take note of your point, but I guess the idea is that that liaisons will not be affected by this. Does that answer your question, Julie?
It does. Is it a question, though, that does the answer need to be recorded in this paper, though? I guess that's really so that other people don't raise the same question.
I'd suggest that we task Jordan's group with making reference to our wish that liaisons are unaffected, and we will check with legal counsel whether we need to have specific reference to that for the bylaw drafting.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you. Ellen is next.
Thank you very much. A number of points. First of all, in paragraph 2, the lead-in and then the first bullet, there seems to be two different thresholds for how many ACs and SOs have to petition. One of them says two-thirds of the SOs and ACs. The other one says one SO and one AC. So I think that's a conflict unless I'm misreading that, and that needs to be clarified. I'll point out that by saying, by including an SE and an AC there, there is only one AC that's likely to be participating. That's effectively giving a veto to the ALAC. I don't mind at all, but I'm not sure that was the intent. So we may want to consider that. On the paragraph on the NOMCOM, I don't think that what we referred to, that's the paragraph, I don't know where it is, I think it's numbered 8, the one about NOMCOM holding in reserve. I don't think that's what we agreed to in Paris, but we may want to check that with Cheryl because she was sort of the NOMCOM person who was speaking there, and I may be right or wrong. In terms of the liaisons, the incoming board has the ability to unilaterally remove all of the liaisons, any or all of the liaisons except the GAC liaison. So I don't think we need to worry about that. the incoming board, if they're unhappy with the liaisons, can get rid of them, except for the GAC one, and that one I think we probably have to live with. Lastly, on diversity, I would like Sebastian to propose a methodology by which we can do that, since we are asking each AC and SO to name a person, and that happens in parallel. I don't understand how we could have a mechanism to ensure diversity. We don't have the NOMCOM coming in after the fact, as we do normally, and selecting people based on the current mix. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And with respect to your last point, as you will remember, I have asked for others to support Sebastian's view if they think we need to install a diversity requirement for the interim board or the caretaker board. And in the absence of this additional support, I think we should move on with the language suggested in the text as we see it in the AC room. Let me just try to capture the points that you mentioned. I'm sure that Jordan and team will check for consistency with thresholds. We take note of the language on ACs is captured, not allow or rectified if need be, to not give ALEC a special right in this. So I think this maintains the spirit of our thinking. We just need to make sure that the language is correct. So I think that doesn't need further deliberations by the group. I'm not sure I entirely understood where you saw the diverging or the different position that has been put into this paper opposed to the Paris discussions. If we have Cheryl on the call, which I'm not, yeah, Cheryl is there, I guess. Maybe Cheryl can double check, shed some light on it at a later stage in this call. So that's also taken note of. Thank you very much, Alan. And the next in line is Kavis, please.
Yes, I have put my questions in the chat. In paragraph 2, first bullet, please add simple before majority, because majority has no meaning. Simple majority has a clear legal meaning, that is 50% plus one. This is very simple. On paragraph 8, I put in the chat, why, in case of recall of the board, NOMCOM provide 8 directors only required to have 2 candidates. Why 2? That is the question. And in paragraph 9, to perhaps address the point raised by Sebastian, we may add the word necessarily between is and not. Is not between not and subject, is not necessarily subject to diversity. We cannot go to diversity for the short term of few months. That is very, very difficult, but we may qualify that in one way or other. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kabus. I'm not sure whether your answer has been sufficiently answered. Your question has been sufficiently answered on the first point by Jordan in the chat. There are no further hands raised, which leads me to believe that we have mainly wordsmithing to be done. So pending Cheryl's confirmation of the different view discussed in Paris, we might be good to go with the language on the table, or with the spirit of the language on the table. James has raised his hand. James, please, fire away.
Sorry, James Gannon. So I'd like to reach out to both the chairs and others, but I think we might have an issue with paragraph 8. I thought the agreement in Paris was that the NOMCOM would not participate in electing anybody to the interim board, that they wouldn't participate in that process at all, that the 2 candidates was a separate issue for, not related to the interim board. So I think we need to, I think we might have an issue with paragraph 8 that we need to discuss. I think that's different to what was agreed in Paris with regards to the NOMCOM's participation in the interim board, that we agreed that the NOMCOM would not elect anybody to the interim board until its next AGM.
Good. I guess that that's helpful. Jordan, maybe you can also help me with this. Shall we try to make sure that the language is aligned with what's been discussed in Paris? You know, now that that these points are made, recollection comes back. So I think we might to put in an exemption for the NOMCOM. Jordan?
Well, I don't think that we settled it, and I think that there are arguments both ways. One simplicity argument is that you leave out the NOMCOM appointment process for the short-term interim board, and if they've selected some reservists, that they can be pulled into service for the replacement board, if you like. But the downside of that is that what you'll have on the board of directors is the chief executive, and you'll then have between 4 and 7 directors appointed by the at-large community and the SOs, and that's it. So to me, the logic of making sure there are a couple of NOMCOM people there is just to balance that out. And so that's just a logical point. I don't have a theological or ideological view about it. If people think it will make life easier to not have them on it, that's fine by me. I just don't know where the view of the group is. So.
Good. But John, let me maybe add for those that haven't been attending the Paris meeting. Legal counsel has clarified that we do not need a fully seated board for the interim board. So we can do with less people. And if there are concerns in the group about the NOMCOM being able to put more, the full number of people to the table, why don't we then maybe move to a compromise position where, you know, the SOs and ACs, they bring names to the table when it comes to this discussion. For NOMCOM, we encourage NOMCOM to, you know, if reasonably possible, they should bring in a sufficient number of all board members they nominate, but we wouldn't make it a must for them. And maybe that can help reconcile the different views.
It's creative, Thomas, but I think it's exactly there already. So the NOMCOM has 8 appointees on the board generally. This would ask it to supply 2 candidates. And I agree that the language isn't entirely specific in saying that it either must or can. So we could say can. But I think that is already a compromise for a much smaller board. You can imagine each SO and AC only appointing 1, and these 2 would give you a board of 6 compared to the normal 16, 7 instead of 16 in the CEO. So if in that first red part of paragraph 8 we said, in addition, the NOMCOM will amend its processes so that it would be able, if, you know, I don't really know how you make it less determinative than this.
Can you say shall?
Okay, this is such a bad idea to try and do the drafting, right? If we're clear about the intention, then we can do the drafting in WP1. But just be clear about the intention.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm trying to get at, to make the language or to capture the ideas of what shall be in the clause. James, I'm not sure whether that's a new hand. If so, please speak up.
Hi, James Gannon. Yes, it is. So I'll be very brief. So my concern, and I'll say why I would support the NOMCOM not necessarily appointing board members to the interim board, is if the NOMCOM has to find 2 potential directors at extremely short notice, those directors may not be sufficiently up to speed on the crisis situation that ICANN may be in at the time of a full board recall. So I would have concerns about the ability of the NOMCOM to find somebody on such short notice who has sufficient that they would be able to fulfill the requirements of the interim board. And let's remember it's only an interim board that we're selecting here. Whereas I would have a higher level of confidence in the AC and SOs being able to find director candidates who will be up to a sufficient level to take over those critical responsibilities at a time of extreme, you know, disablement of ICANN, possibly. So that would be my argument for possibly not including the NOMCOM. If the NOMCOM was able to find directors that matched those requirements that we'll set out in Workstream 2, then I'd support their ability to do that, but I would be strongly against requiring them to do so.
Thanks, James. I guess that's helpful for us to understand. However, I would trust the NOMCOM will not place people they do not deem appropriate on the board. And I think that if we don't make it mandatory for them to seat all board members they have control over, that might sufficiently safeguard ICANN from being landed with inadequate board members. So if I could ask you, James, not now, but between now and the next session, to consider that and hopefully agree to it, I would suggest that we move on the basis of keeping this spirit of what we've discussed. We are going to close the queue after Tijani. We need to move on to the next point. I take note of Caboose's question not having been sufficiently answered. I'm afraid we need to move on with the agenda. So, Caboose, can I please ask you to send an email with your question, and we will make sure that either I or Jordan answer that instantly, or you can also put it in the chat, and we will try to publicly answer it in the chat. Evan.
Thank you very much. Just to point out that way, way, way back in the chat, Cheryl did confirm that the decision in Paris was the NOMCOM would sit out on the interim board and presumably would use any people they have in reserve to name to the permanent board, which is for the rest of the term. She seems to have perhaps have rethought that based on James' comment. But the confirmation we were looking for earlier was made. It just slipped by very quickly, and perhaps no one noticed. Thank you very much.
But are you okay with proceeding on the basis of what was just discussed, make it optional for NOMCOM? I'll make that language a little bit more explicit.
I presume I'm not going to speak on behalf of the NOMCOM, never having sat on one and never having chaired one. I think Cheryl said yes, that could work, but I don't really want to speak on behalf. I was just clarifying what did happen in Paris.
I take that not to be an objection, which I thank you for. Next in line is Tijani. Tijani?
Thank you, Thomas. Sorry if I was... Yes. If I understood well, if we decided that we will have each SO and AC appoint only one member, we will have and the total four members from the AC and from the AC and the SOs, and plus the CEO, five. That's why we said in Paris that at least two members from the NOMCOM. At least you will have at least seven members for the board. I think that the board can function with only four or five members. Thank you.
Thanks, Tijani. And maybe Jordan's group can reflect that in an updated language, so that there should at least be the aspiration of have two NOMCOM members. Caboose has raised his hand. Caboose.
The time to put my comment in chat, but it seems that people attempt to say that they don't understand what I'm saying. In paragraph 8, you have an addition saying that, in addition, the NOMCOM will amend its processes so as to be able to supply two candidates for the interim board. Why two candidates? NOMCOM has 8 board members. If you recall the entire board, 16 directors, NOMCOM should have 8 directors to be supplied for the interim, unless I misunderstood the situation. You want to limit the NOMCOM during the interim, not to have 8 directors, but only 2. Is that the case? Thank you.
No, Kabus. I guess there's a misunderstanding here, and we may not have communicated that clearly enough. There's no legal requirement to have the full number of board members. Concerns have been raised, and not only by many participants or individuals in the group, that NOMCOM might not have 8 eligible or qualified candidates at their fingertips at the point in time when the board is recalled, which is why it is allowed for the NOMCOM to place a lower number. That is not to marginalize the role of the NOMCOM, but to help the NOMCOM out of the predicament of being forced to provide more members to caretaker boards than they have available. There is full flexibility for the NOMCOM to place 8 people on the interim board, but they do not have to do so, and it is my belief that wherever the NOMCOM has a sufficient number of qualified candidates in their repertoire, they will bring them forward. Okay, I think that should answer the question. If not, Kabus, I'm afraid we really need to take this offline. I'm not sure, is that an old hand or a new hand?
What you said is different from what is in the paragraph 8. So paragraph 8 should be amended exactly as you said, saying that there may be not possibilities that NOMCOM has 8 replacement directors during there. So therefore, the minimum 2 it should be provided. It is not mentioned there. So please kindly advise those who written paragraph 8 to revise it exactly as you have indicated. And I thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Kabus. And we've already marked as an action item to make that language more explicit. So you can expect an updated version of this language for the next call. And in response to Martin's question in the chat, Tijani has recorded from the Paris meeting that we spoke about the number of 2, and in my view, we should have that at least as an aspiration in the next language to be reviewed by the whole group. But I think that we're getting very close to where we need to be. I take note that there haven't been any concerns apart from the general concern raised by Sebastian over the other aspects of this language. So we should limit our focus and our discussion to the points that have now been tagged as still to be finalized for our to-do list. So with that, I think we should close this part of the agenda, and for the next part of the discussion, I'd like to hand over to Leon.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And now we will be discussing the power on the budget veto. There are some outstanding questions. I think one of the key issues is the number of successive vetoes that we can we would be willing to go on when exercising this power. And we have mainly 3 outstanding questions that we need to answer, and I hope we can discuss this openly. The first one being, which would be a reasonable time for the community to consider a budget before deciding to veto it, especially given the requirement that the issues are raised during the public consultation. So we need to find out how much time would be, of course, reasonable for us to review the budget that the board would publish, and then we exercise a veto on it. Then the second question would be, which would be a reasonable time for the board this time to consider the community objections to a budget or a strategic plan before they respond with a revised budget. So as we've discussed, this would be an iterative process in which we would, of course, review what the board has come up to, provide comments, and then in that respect, of course, the board would need to revise and answer to those comments and come back to us with a revised budget. And the third question is a key question that also deals with the dependencies that we have with the CWG. And the question is whether we believe that the ICANN and the IANA budgets should be treated separately in terms of thresholds and LUC minimum for the IANA functions based on the previous year's budget. So with that, I would like to turn now to Jordan again to just take us to the general aspects of the paper on budget veto. Jordan?
Thanks, Leon. This is quite a gory paper with a whole bunch of redlining in it. You have highlighted in your introduction one of the kind of key issues. So this version of this paper was one that was discussed at WP1 18 hours ago, and there hasn't been an update yet. But where we still have a little bit of uncertainty about whether we need to call out separately the IANA budget or not. We're getting mixed signals on the email from the CWG. So I think we need to keep that conversation going to resolve that one. There was agreement to limit to round trips two vetoes in a row. But then there was a difference of opinion about what happens after a second veto. So when you veto, if the community mechanism vetoes the budget, it goes back to the board and the board has to propose a revised budget. If it, if the community then vetoes it again, a second veto, the question is what happens after that. Some people, including myself, have assumed that after that second veto, the board proposes a third version of the budget. And if you've run out of vetoes, there's nothing else you can do as a community using the veto power. You've had your two vetoes, the board has insisted, and then you can use the other community powers if you like. You can remove the board or you can remove directors, have your impact that way. Other members of WP1 have said that actually what happens after a second veto, if the community doesn't accept the board's second budget, the corporation will continue on the previous year's budget for the entire year. So the second veto doesn't then lead to a third board proposed budget. It just leads to the caretaker budget carrying on for the rest of the year. So I think we need some clarity about that. I have a different recollection of it from Steve and from Jonathan. So, Leon, it would be helpful to somehow just test the views of the CWG on this, if you like. Alternatively, you're welcome to leave it for discussion in the Working Party 1 meeting next week, because if you've read this paper carefully, you'll see that there are some... It's not worded in the most straightforward way at the moment. It does need a pretty clear redraft. But we do need to know and answer that question about what happens after the second veto. So I don't have anything to add to that.
Thank you very much, Jordan. So as you see, the discussion or the key aspects to answer with regards to the budget is how many times do we want to give a round trip for vetoing the budget. And I see already Jonathan Suk has his hand up. Jonathan, could you please take the floor?
Thanks, Leon. Jonathan Suk for the record. Yeah, I think to boil this down, the essential question is whether or not, the board could outlast the community by simply continuing to propose the same budget until the community ran out of vetoes. Or if the prior year's budget that would prevail until something came about to change it. I don't know if it would be for the entire year, because I guess the assumption would be that there'd be some escalation of board removal, board member removal, or some of the other tools that are available, accountability tools that are available to the community that might bring about a new budget. We're talking about limiting the number of round trips. It's a question of what happens when you reach that limit, and does the board win or does the community win, if you will. And that's essentially the scenario that we were trying to tease out in the last WP1 meeting. And it was Steve's and my recollection, and I don't know everybody else's from the chat, but that the assumption was that the board would be stuck with the prior year's budget at the point at which the community ran out of vetoes.
Thanks, Jonathan. So what I'm hearing is that we would be leaning towards maybe an unlimited number of round trips. Is that correct?
Well, in further discussion, that limit on round trips has actually been called into question as well. Should the community mechanism to preserve the prior year's budget simply be continuous vetoing, so that there's always a chance for a new budget, as opposed to being stuck, with the prior year's budget for the remainder of the year, simply because the community's run out of vetoes. So the compromise, I guess, position between the two recollections of Paris is that you remove the cap on vetoes, and then the community has the ability to preserve the prior year's budget by simply continuing to veto the budget proposal from the board until such time as the board presents a budget the community can live with.
Thanks, Jonathan. I see Cavus has a concern that's being put in the chat box, and this concern relates to protecting the IANA budget, and I see some support for of course protecting the IANA budget. So I also see the queue going larger. So next on the queue will be Mathieu.
Thank you, Ian. This is Mathieu speaking. I think when considering this question about the number of iterations of potential vetoes, we need to keep in mind the thresholds for obtaining a veto, which is a two-third level of support on round one, and then later three quarters, which means that if there was adverse consequences for the IANA budget, for instance, obviously these consequences would be displayed up front, or at least after the first round of veto, probably. And so that would mean that these consequences would be accepted by at least two-thirds of the community, and then three-quarters after that. And if we look at how our community votes are spread, that means that two-thirds of CCNSO, GNSO, ASO, ALAC, and then three-quarters of the same vote against the budget. And they will be aware of the consequences for IANA. And as a CCTLD manager, obviously the IANA budget is of prime importance. And I guess the CCNSO votes, if they go against the budget, it will be because there's a problem with the IANA budget, or I am aware, we are aware, of the consequences for the IANA budget. And if you look at ASO, I expect it would be similar. So with 50% of the votes being necessary to get that veto, I think we should not be too preoccupied of a veto that would affect the IANA budget, because it's going to be on the table, and ASO and CCNSO certainly won't get IANA budget into trouble. I think we need to keep things a little simpler because we have high thresholds, and avoid getting into too many complex details of giving the board the ability to have the last word and everything. I'm more personally in favor of actually an infinite number of vetoes because of these high thresholds and a budget that is not supported by at least 25%, which means one SO or AC, to me is not a good thing for ICANN in itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Next on the queue, I have Craig Shetton.
Thank you, Greg Shatton, for the record. I'm wondering if, in terms of trying to resolve this issue of two vetoes, infinite number of vetoes, whether we should give some consideration or more consideration to having some kind of a meet and consult requirement, because it seems to me that this is, if there are issues with the budget, and we know we're not giving line item vetoes, but clearly it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that could be worked out in discussions. So, you know, and try to solve the problems. Now, I expect, frankly, that even if we didn't put it in the document informally, there would be discussions that would, you know, hopefully take place that would result in a mutually acceptable solution. To take the language regarding GAC advice, which maybe we could even take here, because it seems to me that the idea of kind of lobbing vetoes and budgets kind of back at each other, it's probably not realistic to think it actually could occur, but we should make sure that it can't occur, that there is a rational process of trying to eliminate the conflict. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Craig. Next, I have Jordan.
Thanks. I just wanted to respond to two points. One is in response to what Caboose was saying in the chat. Caboose, the draft does, in fact, say that this process applies separately to the IANA budget. And what I said in the intro was that we need consulting with the CWG to make sure it does that in the right way. So I think we do need to keep doing that, but the point is well made and definitely taken on board. The fact that it maybe isn't very clear in the draft is more ammunition for my thinking that we do need to do a bit of an editing job on this paper before WP1 deals with it next week. The other point I wanted to do was to strongly agree with what Greg just said, which was the idea of a discussion phase. I do think that all of these, you know, for all of the exercise, these community powers, the idea we were starting to come to in Paris was that there should be a discussion in the ICANN Community Assembly or whatever we're calling the community forum before any of the powers are exercised. So before there's the first veto, there should have already been a conversation between the SOs ACs. And that's, remember, that forum will have all of the ACs. It won't just have the ones who are casting votes. So it'll be the board and all of the SOs and ACs having a discussion about why it is that there's these objections before the first veto is cast. So no one's going to be under any misapprehensions. And then if there's a second veto requiring an even higher threshold to deliver it, that would also be preceded by such a conversation. You know, that I think we should incorporate that in all of the powers. Personally, I think that's where we were going. So that provides some of it. In Workstream 2, we can work on further improvements, discourse, and dialogue there. So that's also a prospect. But I just wanted to agree with the point that discussion and dialogue has to be part of these things, along with the hard edges of the powers involved.
Thanks, Jordan. I think this clears Kevo's concern. I see that Kavuz, your hand was right
yes,
after
yes,
Jordan,
yes.
And then
yes, my hand is up.
Raised it again.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I'll go to you now, Kavuz.
Yeah, thank you. Paragraph 106 of CWD, after describing the dependency of the CWD to CCWD, continues as follows. If any element of these ICANN level accountability mechanism is not implemented as contemplated by the CWD stewardship proposal, the CWG stewardship proposal will require revision, specifically the proposed legal structure and overall CWG stewardship proposal requires ICANN accountability, so on and so forth. In the GAC and several others, when we agree to the proposal of CWG, we made direct reference to this paragraph 106 and we quoted part of this paragraph. If by this overall budget, the IANA budget will be at risk because of the veto of the board after one time or two time and so on and so forth, we would have serious difficulty for the entire transition of ICG. We need to either ensure that this IANA budget will not be affected or make a separation between IANA budget and overall budget to have different procedures and different practices. This is very important. On 29th of July, in 5 o'clock in the morning, UTC, I will declare to the ICG that I am not ensured that this provision is valid. Therefore, I warn the ICG to put that, unfortunately, there is no guarantee that IANA budget is ensured to comply with the CWG. Therefore, transition may not take place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. So, as I said, I guess that currently the paper does reflect that the IANA budget would be treated differently and independently with regards to voting thresholds and the general ICANN budget. And the worst-case scenario, to my mind, would be that the IANA functions department, or in this case, the the BTI, would be functioning under the previous year's budget in the worst-case scenario. So I guess that this would somehow address your concerns and, of course, the CWG dependency. But of course, it needs to be reflected into the final version of this document. Next in the queue, I have Greg Shadden again. Greg?
That's an old hand.
Okay, then I have Jonathan. Jonathan?
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to answer a couple of questions. I mean, the question of escrow is coming up in the chat, and I just want to make clear that there's no scenario under which there's no money for ICANN, that all that happens in the context of a veto is the equivalent of what we call here a continuing resolution, meaning that the budget from last year just continues into the current year. So this talk of escrow, et cetera, isn't related to the budget. Escrow is related to insolvency or not having enough money to run the IANA functions. This is just about the budget for the following year. So that's one point. There would always be money for IANA despite any conflict between the community and the board. The second, Cavus, just to be clear, is that the proposal you have in front of you right here and now separates the IANA budget from the general budget. So the thing you're suggesting has been incorporated into this current draft. The two of them are treated separately and can be addressed separately. So I think both those points are important, and it's just a question of, you know, how to break the deadlock and to keep it from being last year's budget or the prior year's budget indefinitely, and that was the sort of the source of the question by limiting the number of vetoes, et cetera. But there's no scenario under which the budget for IANA is somehow not available.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. So in order to provide guidance to the working party, I would like to just come to closure on what we've discussed. And I would like to just confirm whether we agree that the IANA budget and the general ICANN budget should be treated independently. Is there any objection to this? Okay, so I see no objection to treating and reflecting in the paper that the Working Party will be refining that the IANA budget and the ICANN general budget should be treated independently with regards to the veto process. Then the second question or the second point that I would like to confirm as to guide Working Party 1 is that we do agree that given that we will be treating the IANA budget in an independent way or in a separate way from the ICANN general budget, we agree to have, let's say, an infinite number of round trips to the number of vetoes. And are there any objections to having an infinite number of round trips with regards to the veto process? Okay, so I see no objections to having an infinite number of round trips. And then the next two questions would remain. And I note that there is an objection by Sebastian Bachelet. And I believe that that refers to the infinite number of round trips to the veto. So the objection is noted. But I think we have an overall agreement from the rest of the working group, so this would provide guidance to the working party. So are there any other questions or comments with regards to the budget tower at this point? Okay. So now the only two questions remaining are the times for reviewing either the budget and for the board to come back on the revised budget. So here I would ask for your guidance on whether 15 days is enough for the community to review the proposed budget and 15 days for the board to come back with a revised budget. And I think Cabus had this up. Cabus?
On the nature of the community, I don't believe that 15 days is sufficient. I suggest that we increase it. Increase the 15 days to 30 calendar days. 15 days is not enough. Thank you.
Okay, so 15 calendar days, I believe it's reasonable. It doesn't stretch the timeline too far, but it also gives a little bit more of time to consider the budget. I see Jordan. Jordan, would you like to react to that?
I just want to tease out the timing thing. So, first of all, the budget won't have been a mystery in its genesis because there will have been a community engagement process in developing the budget. Secondly, there are three time periods to think about here. The first time period is how long after the board announces the budget is there available for the SOs and ACs to petition to consider a veto? And what we've said is that that period should be 15 days. So the petitioning amount is proposed to be 15 days. And sorry, I can't just find exactly
the paragraph that that's in, and that's why we need to restructure this document so it's all in the right order. And then what happens after the petition? So then the proposal was that there would be a period there for a discussion in the community forum and then a decision. So already with those two 15 days, you've got a 30-day maximum period from when a petition can be initiated. So for us, that seems like long enough, and was adding sort of 30 days overall to the budget planning process. So those three steps, remember, the time period to petition, maximum of 15 days. If a petition happens to cause the discussion, there would be another 15 days for that consideration to happen, and then a decision taken afterwards. And my personal view is that we should standardize that three-stage process across all of the community powers so that everyone will easily know how it works, and we just need to get the language right on that as well. And I wish we'd had time to do that for this paper, but we haven't quite got it there yet.
Thank you very much for this clarification, Jordan. I think it's very useful to know that times didn't come out of nowhere, but rather they are tied to a process. And I see Jonathan hand this up. Jonathan, could you please say the floor?
I guess all I was going to do was reiterate what I did say in the chat, which was that there was some concern raised by Krista Spain that the budget was already stretched for timing. And so that's sort of the context in which we're doing this. So trying to figure out, these turnaround times is somewhat constrained. But as Jordan said, the other requirement that came out of Paris is that the objections to the budget would have to be based on issues that were raised in the community feedback process already. So it's not like, here's a new budget, and now you have 15 days to review it and decide whether to veto. It's 15 days after it's already gone through an extensive public review process in which issues were raised that the board chose to not to accommodate. And so that's why a short turnaround time seems appropriate. That and overall, the budget's already stretched in terms of its timing, so it's important not to let this drag on indefinitely.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And I'm closing the queue with Sebastian Bachelet. Next to the queue is Cavus.
Yes, after the explanation of Jordan, now I understand the total period for the review would be 30 days, consisting of 15 days. The first 15 days is for the petition. The second 15 days for the community to react. But the total of the 30 days, in my view, is sufficient. We should not have longer than that one, because if we have longer, we have adverse effect. But it is not mentioned properly or described properly in the text. We should say that the total period is 30 days, consisting of 15 days. The first is for the petition, the second is for the decision. If that is written in that way, the misunderstanding will be removed. So I apologize, I misunderstood it, but now I understand after explanation if it is properly reflected in the text. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus, and we will ask the working party to reflect it this way, so there is no room for misunderstanding. Next on the queue, I have Sebastian.
Yes, thank you, Leon. Sebastian Bachelet. I just want to reiterate my point of view. It's very difficult today to have the budget voted at the June meeting of ICANN, and it happens that it's pushed to already to July, and I don't think that adding day will help to have a best budget. We need to be able to have the community, the staff, and the board working during the creation of the budget to do the work. And I reiterate my point of view that it's what we need to do and not to try to add new processes on top of already a very packed agenda to create a budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. So I think we've widely discussed this issue on the power of budget vetoing, and we still have some items on our agenda and very short time. So I would now move on to the next agenda item and turn back to Mathieu.
Thank you, Leon. Mathieu Veil speaking. This item is about the community mechanism, which is basically a common point of all the powers. And I think we have, considering the time we have left and the remaining items to be discussed, to probably focus on one item that is of importance for the remaining of our work and was mentioned by Cavus earlier, which was the name of this group. But Jordan, would you like to introduce any other topic on this one?
No.
Okay, so that's I think you've used in your group the ICANN community assembly type of wording. We've been using community forum for a while.
Yeah. And there's been a number of names floating around: community council, community forum, community assembly. You'll remember, I think, at the end of the Paris meeting, we were trying to be clear that this would just be a discussion forum. It isn't where the decisions of the SOs and ACs are made, the voting ones that form the member. And it does include all of the SOs and ACs, not only the ones with votes, to be the forum for dialogue before powers are exercised.
Thanks, Jordan. And I will turn to Cavus, but probably what we could do would be to test the waters on the potential names so that we can provide a clear direction for the drafting and avoid a lot of rewriting at the end. Cavus?
Yes, did I understand it correctly, that we have community mechanism as a sole member model, and then
yes,
we have ICANN community assembly? There are two different things. Right or wrong?
So the assembly or forum is a group where people meet, while the sole member is the legal construction that passes on the message as the sole member of ICANN.
So the ICANN community assembly is the coverage under which this community mechanism, sole members, and so on and so forth, they meet and decide. If that is the case, we should have some explanation or some title, and explaining title, ICANN community mechanism, and underneath of that, we explain that the community mechanism as a sole membership or sole member is under that, and so on and so forth. We don't have any more anything about forum, nothing about council. We have one single definition, one single term, ICANN Community Assembly. Is it a correct understanding or misunderstood?
Jordan wanted to respond.
A mix, Cavus. You're right that we will only refer to the ICANN Community Assembly or whatever it is that we choose to call it. We want one name and absolutely no confusion. But it is not the body where the decisions are made. All of the decisions are made by the four or five or however many SOs and ACs have the power to cast the votes. And the decisions are made by those SOs or ACs according to their own processes. What the forum does is bring all of the SOs and ACs together to have a cross-community discussion, a little bit like this CCWG, before any of the powers are exercised. So it's the cross-community collaboration and discussion about these accountability powers. That's what the forum is for. That's what the assembly is for. Sorry, I should use the single language unless we are changing it. So we need to have a separate section in this part of the report, and we will do that. At the moment, it's a paper that hasn't been finished yet for WP1 to discuss. So if we can keep at this point the discussion, as Mathieu suggested, just to what we want to call it, that will be good, because then over the weekend we can update all of the drafts so that we've just got the one label, and we'll have a paper for the next meeting that sets out
the details of what the assembly is and does.
Thanks, Jordan. Very quick one, Alan and Cavus, and then we'll test the waters using the AC room, so prepare your green or red ticks.
Yes, fair enough, the explanations. I understood this is something that Malcolm proposed in Paris as community forum, and now we call them ICANN Community Assembly. Is the arrangement before community decide on something and so on and so forth, some sorts of consultation, but should be properly explained or described. If that would be the case, I have no problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. We will do that. Alan?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. Jordan said all the ACs and SOs. It is all the ones, not just the ones who are participating in the community mechanism, and that's an important thing that came out of Paris, and we don't want to lose. So just clarity. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm not going to ask for preferences, but rather objections. So can I get red ticks for anyone objecting to the term ICANN Community Assembly in the AC room, please? I'm seeing one from Samantha. Now, please reset. Would there be any objection to the term community forum? Red tick, please. Red crosses, sorry. And that's Sebastian. So I think, and Anand. So I think Work Party 1 can work something out, and that's not going to be our most difficult decision to make. And with that, I will now thank Jordan for the tremendous amount of work that has been done with the Work Party 1 and encourage him to still continue because a lot remains to be done, and move on to Thomas, where we try and address a bit of Work Party 2. Thomas?
Sorry, I was talking to a muted microphone. Yes, in this next agenda item, we're going to talk about mission and core values. So that's being taken care of by Becky. And I would like to ask Becky to show us through the recent changes that have been made to the document.
Thank you. This is, we have, I think we discussed this earlier this week. We have done some revisions, pretty much meant to clarify. The changes here are just in on page one are just wording changes, which we discussed on Tuesday. The changes in the ICANN shall have no power to act other than in accordance with and is reasonably appropriate to achieve its mission. Following the call, we decided that necessary might be too constricting, and so appropriate to achieve its mission was the proposal from WP2. There are no changes in the balancing of provision from what we talked about. The human rights issue remains open, and there are strong feelings from some participants that the fundamental bylaws should include an obligation for ICANN to consider the impact of its policy actions on fundamental human rights. There are equally strong views on the other side that believe, first of all, there is an obligation to comply with fundamental human rights that is imported through the involvement, through the reference to ICANN's obligation to comply with international law. And second, while this is an extremely important topic that deserves appropriate consideration, we should do that as part of work stream two. So that issue remains open. There are no further changes in these provisions. These are provisions that we talked about. A couple of issues in this construct about while remaining rooted in the private sector. One, the Work Party 2 intended to clarify that the reference to private sector, which has been historically in this document, is inclusive of not only business stakeholders, but civil society, the technical community, and academia. There's language about the responsibility of recognizing that governments and public policy are responsible and public authorities are responsible for public policy within their jurisdictions. And then in response to the very strong concerns that we heard from members of the GAC in particular regarding ICANN's obligations with respect to the advice of government and public policy, we have tried very hard to come up with a solution that addresses those concerns. First of all, that we remove that language from these bylaws. The duty of ICANN to work cooperatively with the GAC to find a solution, a mutually acceptable solution, remains in place in all accounts. Nothing diminishes that obligation. We clarify in the chapeau, the general section of Article 11 that applies to all advisory committees, that ICANN has no authority to act or refrain from acting in response to advice that would require such advice would require ICANN to exceed its mission or violate these bylaws, or where the advisory committee has not provided a rationale for its advice. Additional providing a rationale for its advice is the language from ATRT 2, which obligated ICANN and the GAC to work together, or which asked recommended that ICANN and the GAC work together to develop a mechanism for the GAC to provide a rationale for its advice at the time it's published. We've checked that, and it doesn't seem to have progressed, at least as far as the scorecard that I was able to find are. Now, let me just say, again, this has no impact on ICANN's obligation to work cooperatively with the GAC to find a mutually acceptable solution in the event that ICANN elects not to follow the GAC advice. And that includes discussion and working together to provide a solution when ICANN feels that complying with the GAC advice would require it to exceed its mission or violate its bylaws. So the goal, and I think a goal that has been achieved, is that it has absolutely no impact on the GAC's special status regarding the advice and the mutually acceptable solution. It merely articulates what we all believe is a current state of affairs, that ICANN has no authority to act or refrain from acting in response to advice that would cause it to violate its bylaws. We have heard from some people that this should apply across the board, not just to advisory committees, but to supporting organizations, which I think no one particularly objects to. And so the two issues that remain open, as I said, are human rights, whether there be a specific reference to ICANN's obligation to consider its human right impact, whether that should be a work stream one issue or a work stream two issue, and then the second is the proposed solution to address the concerns we heard in Paris regarding the language, the proposed changes to existing bylaw, core value number 11.
Thanks very much, Becky. I guess that's very helpful. With respect to the first topic, and I would suggest that we discuss these points one after the other. The first open topic is human rights, and I would suggest that we take note that of the interim findings as well. So I think we should put explicit language into our report that the question of human rights has been part of this group's deliberation. We should put into the report that our group is willing to work on this and will not put it on the back burner. We should, as you did in this report, but maybe we can be a little bit more explicit into the report that the reference that is being made to international law is understood as being a reference to human rights as well. So it has indirect reference in the bylaws. I guess what the group has not decided or answered at this stage is whether explicit mentioning of human rights should be made in the bylaws. The mechanism for our deliberations is that we are working on changes to ICANN's current paperwork. At the moment, you do know that there is no explicit mentioning of human rights, which is why I think the appropriate way of finding a way forward is to check whether the request to put human rights explicitly into the bylaws is promising to get consensus. So far, I think Avi has been leading on that topic. I think two other individuals in this group have supported it. I think we have seen more or heard more individuals speak against it in terms of timing, making our work more complex at this stage, and also expressing the wish to understand better what the implications of explicit mentioning of human rights are. So I would really like to check with the group whether there are additional supporters for such language to be included beyond the ones that that have already spoken up. Robin's hand is raised. Robin, please, fire away.
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so I would like to propose that we not put human rights into work stream two entirely. I mean, we have to sort out the details there, but I think what we can do in work stream one is just provide a simple commitment to fundamental human rights and ICANN's policies and operations. Full stop. And that's what we should put in the bylaws. I think that might be a compromise that could address some of the concerns about the need to explicitly call out fundamental human rights and the concerns about that some of the other calls may go too far. So I think that might be a compromise that we could live with. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robin. Before we move to David, let me just note that Sabina has raised concerns with that potentially not being very simple, and Sam supporting that. Next in line is David.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Thomas. And I think, as you know from the discussions in WP2, this is going to take some time. I am one of those who believes that this should be put in Workstream 2, and the reference that Robin suggests, I think, has got repercussions that we don't know about, and this takes time to sort this out. It is important. I agree with Avery and Robin. It's extremely important. There is a working party in ICANN that's working on social responsibility and human rights. And I just think that ICANN is not currently a hotbed of human rights violations, and that this takes time to consider the implications of this language. It's absolutely appropriate, but a simple statement like that could carry deep repercussions that we just simply need to think through. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Greg?
I'll be brief. I agree with David and what Sabine said in the chat. This is not simple. This is complicated, and this is something that I think requires due study and deliberation, and I think it's an appropriate subject for Workstream 2 or perhaps for a separate body. But given that we have this body, we might as well use it in Workstream 2. I do not think it's an essential part of Workstream 1, and we have much to learn and to discuss about this issue. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Caboose, and I'm going to close the two after Caboose.
I think what Robin proposed is acceptable. It would be a pity and disappointing that CCWG start to modify or amend bylaw. And in that new bylaw, there are many, many things, but there's no sign or no reference to human rights. So we have to mention that. The way she proposed is absolutely right, does not have any implications. In fact, it increased the image of ICANN, increased the image of community that this important element has been recognized by everybody. However, the detail of which requires further analysis and discussion, that will be on Workstream 2. But we have to mention some minimum elements, a reference to that, very important. Otherwise, we will be criticized that we do many, many things, but we forget to recognize one of the very important elements that every organization these days are talking about. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Caboose. Obviously, we have different views in the group on if something needs to be included in the bylaws, and if so, what needs to be included. Let me also say that I have heard no one speak against of this group dealing with the question of human rights at all. So this is about whether language should be included, explicit language should be included in the bylaws in this very first phase. Even at a later stage, once the group has done more in-depth assessment of the impact of fundamental human rights or human rights, that can still lead to a bylaw change. As I said at the outset of our discussion, there is, the way we would operate is take what we have and add to it or amend. So currently there's no mentioning of human rights explicitly in the bylaws, and I would really like to test the waters whether there is sufficient traction for continuing that debate right now. We are clear, and that's I think common ground. It needs to be worked on. I think nobody is against the inclusion in Workstream number 2. Nobody, I've heard no one being against providing a rationale for this, highlighting the importance of the topic. The question is, do we put it in the bylaws at this stage. So I would really like to do a straw poll to test the atmosphere in the room. Can you please go to the Adobe section where you can agree or disagree, and can you please indicate whether you agree to explicitly mentioning fundamental bylaws, fundamental human rights in the bylaws at this stage? If you do not want it included, i.e. maintain the status quo of not having it explicitly mentioned, please use the disagree button. So we have 49 people in the room. Can I please ask that more of you use this polling mechanism? The audio is still working, but I just want to give it a little more time for people to find the right button in the upper left section of their Adobe room to indicate their support for the inclusion of explicit language or their disagreement with that inclusion. So at this stage, we do see substantially more disagreement than agreement. All those that wanted to vote, please do participate in this poll. I should not say vote. This is just to indicate where we should head with our discussions. So there's much more traction for not including it at this stage. Avery, who had introduced the topic, had indicated that she considers or will file a minority statement for the report, and certainly that is a perfectly legitimate request, and we will honor that. I will discuss this with the co-chairs, but I think there is not sufficient traction for us to make explicit reference to human rights at this stage. I would nonetheless I will not repeat, but I will make reference to the interim findings that I highlighted that indicate that this group will deal with the question of human rights, and maybe Avi would be willing to assist with that so that we make sure that it's been dealt with in a timely fashion. Cavus, I'm not sure whether that's an old hand or a new hand.
For temperature of the room perhaps might be slightly different if you say there is any objection to make the minimum reference that human rights is an important and fundamental issue to be addressed. And that will be addressed in the work stream too. Is it at least something on the beginning of the bylaws or somewhere, introduction, pre-word, or preface or something that not totally forgetting, not put in the report. Is it a way that address that? If not in a explicit provision of bylaw in the beginning of the bylaw, preface or introductions or something, there might be, we find a room for that. Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. If you go to the transcript, you will find that I have summarized that we will include such rationale. I think it's not appropriate for us to reintroduce a straw poll, which will likely not lead to any other result at this stage. We are 15 minutes past the top of the hour, so we're already in overtime. Nonetheless, I think it's important for our group to have closed this part of our discussion. I'm cognizant of the fact that we need to revisit the question of advice and whether it's being reflected in the bylaws. Nonetheless, I think we should end this call now and continue the conversation on the other matters that remain to be on the agenda in next week's call. I would like to turn to the co-chairs and give them the opportunity to make any last observations. But in the absence of those, I would really like to end the call and not take more of your valuable time. You've been very generous staying on with us today. Thanks so much. It's been a very productive call. Let's keep up this working spirit and talk to you at the next call. Bye-bye, everyone.